For parents to keep their children healthy and safe, reliable, truthful, and accurate information must be made available to them. When disagreement and debate rise up among those who are thought of as experts, this opens the door for things like information, conspiracies to take over, such as the case today with the vaccine schedule for children. As school goes back into session, if it hasn't already in some places, is this open conflict between information sources creating a health risk for children? Joining us to examine this and the facts about vaccines and their development is the CEO of GeoVax, David Dodd. Thanks for being here today, David.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
GeoVax.com, the website. Learn more about, as I said in the introduction, you need facts, truth, and reality, and you go to the source of those who are in the pipeline and creating the pipeline for the safe health care that you certainly want to have for your kids. And that's got to be frustrating for the industry you're in, David, to have competing levels of experts, in this case the CDC as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics, butting heads when you do all you can as vaccine developers to make sure things are safe and everything is done by the book and as how you're demanded to do.
Correct. Typically, people in the industry, for instance, those companies that are producing vaccines for the flu season or have been producing them, they look for guidance from the federal government because that's historically been consistent. You know, what the CDC or the federal government recommends as the strain, et cetera, is in sync with usually with WHO, and it's also in sync with any of the medical groups, especially the American Academy of Pediatrics. I can tell you because I've been in meetings with colleagues of mine who represent those companies that have to produce those vaccines so that people are appropriately vaccinated either for the flu or for starting school. And there's confusion, and there's been confusion this year. And so that creates confusion for people within the industry because you're looking for guidance because at the end of the day, you want to produce what is going to be utilized so that it's available when people want to have their children vaccinated or themselves vaccinated. So it does create that confusion, and it's a rarity that we've seen now where there is a difference of opinion between the CDC or the federal government and the American Academy of Pediatrics or a medical group and maybe other types of medical groups. And it has much greater implications than just confusions on industry or even, massive confusions for parents or caretakers, et cetera. But in some cases, it has the impact because reimbursement. So some follow what the federal government recommends, and that's consistent with the reimbursement coming from insurers. And if that is not in sync, and you're getting guidance from your pediatrician if something different and all, then it will impact potentially access to the vaccines as well as reimbursement or coverage for you for that. And so it has more implications than one might just think right offhand.
How about regarding costs of producing vaccines? If you know who the vaccine is needs to be designed for, does that streamline the cost versus having to make a more generic, I don't know if that would be the correct term or not, vaccine to cover as many bases as possible with the hope that policy will dictate a more fine-tooth comb than it does right now? But does that uncertainty or the conflict between the government and medical associations run the risk of adding costs to the production of the vaccines, which will obviously impact the medical practices and the insurance companies as well as the consumers?
With that uncertainty, and I think I understand what you're sort of getting at, and I'll touch on it, because that uncertainty, it not only impacts costs, but eventually it also could have an impact on access, because if the guidance is different, because ultimately for children going to school, states decide what are the vaccines that are necessary for a child to be covered by already vaccinated in order to participate in the public school system, et cetera. And usually private schools follow the guidelines within that state also. So when you have this disparity, then what can happen is confusion and not sure what to do from the standpoint of cost and access. What I would point out is it gets into, you go through your planning process, usually starting over the year. It's a continuous basis. So you're planning, you're producing a certain number of doses, and also hundreds of millions or tens of millions of doses or whatever your target is that you're going to be manufacturing. That's not done overnight. So there's lead time. You have to make decisions. Those decisions carry certain inherent risk, because if there's a disagreement, and that disagreement results in, well, if this side says these are the groups that should have it, that's one number, you know, in terms of the sort of total need, let's say, within the United States. And if another side says this is the guidelines that we're recommending and it's a lesser number, then the question is, to what do you produce? Because if the federal government's given you a lower number and you feel that that's going to be the driving one and you produce to that level, but if parents then, in conjunction with discussions with their physicians, family physicians, pediatricians, et cetera, decide we're going to go ahead and seek vaccinations for the others, you can see where if the manufacturers have produced at one level, but in fact the actual demand is going to be significantly greater, the ability within an appropriate, timely manner to be able to produce, if it's necessary, additional product is going to delay that process of vaccination, which could have some health consequences, obviously. Or it could be that some people say, we're just not, you know, we've moved on because we have other slots, so to speak, in our manufacturing for other vaccines that we have. And so we produce as much as we can for this year, so we just won't be able to go back. And, you know, it's not sitting there vacant just waiting for you to go back and say, okay, we now need to do 25% more, or we need to do 50% more. And obviously, if you produce too much, then what you've got is you have the risk of basically having to end up destroying product, because the next year it may be a different strain of what it is, or you may not produce it, and those types of things. So there are a lot of implications here that could, in fact, not only drive cost, could drive access, and could actually have implications on well-being of health, because if you don't produce enough and you needed more, and not everyone who wanted to be vaccinated, who ought to have been vaccinated, should have been vaccinated, it's not as easy as just simply going back to the manufacturing facility, to your production team, and say, okay, crank it back up. We need another 25%. Because they may say, we have a plan that looks out 18 months, and the plan says we're now going to be producing this other vaccine, and we're producing that, so we'll have that. So you can see it creates significant confusion and has several levels of potential implications.
Certainly, for someone dismissing this as a simple disagreement, it's a lot more than that as far as what the effect could possibly be. We're talking with David Dodd, CEO of GeoVax, geovax.com, their website, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. This might sound like an extremely remedial question, but I see so many people treat vaccines as being something that cures the disease. Aren't vaccines, by and large, designed to, at least in hopes and design, prevent a disease?
Yes. A therapy is what is generally referenced or referred to as something that treats the disease. Pardon me, I'm sorry. And a vaccine typically either prevents or it lessens the impact of that particular pathogen or virus or that disease. So, for instance, not all infectious disease vaccines, some prevent. Measles, you get it, and you're pretty much good the rest of your life, so you've been vaccinated. But there are other viruses that continuously evolve, and they may every year present a new variant or a new strain, or they could just be continuously evolving. And what we then try to do in the public health community, you know, industry working together with government and with medical public health officials, try to ensure that durability is such that you only have to reconfigure or reformulate, let's say, once a year. That's a good example would be COVID-19, where they simply have been lasting. The first generation that's out there, so the mRNA vaccine, the Novavax, they appear to last maybe 3 to 6 months. And then every time a major new strain or variant emerges that's significant, they have to reconfigure because the old one doesn't work for that one anymore. So you've got this conundrum of having to continuously reconfigure, vaccinate people, and then you're announcing 3 to 4 months later at most, maybe even less sooner, that, hey, you need to come back because we now have another vaccine because it's moved on. So viruses such as SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 is related to that, the mpox or monkeypox type one, which is now in the U.S., it's throughout North America, it's continuing to evolve. Different strains are coming out, some much more, the current one much more deadly than others. So you have to continuously reconfigure with those. So you're, it depends on that. But you are right that generally to prevent a disease, if it is a preventable one, the terms that going after, then it would be a vaccine. The reason we've never had a vaccine successfully developed, for instance, with HIV, is because despite a lot of good work that's been done, and a lot of promise that has been shown, that virus, similar to SARS-CoV-2, which gives us COVID-19, continues to evolve. And because of that, it's very difficult. Whereas with measles, you can take it, you develop a vaccine, and it basically prevents you for life. Now, with COVID-19, I would urge people that the likelihood of having a vaccine that actually fully prevents it is probably very small. What is best is that you want to reduce the risk of someone, especially certain populations who have weak immune systems, or pregnant women, or young immune system immature, young children. All in those situations, what you want to do is provide sufficient, hopefully up to a year, of a vaccination that will last that long, that will lessen the impact should they get that. So instead of having someone that has to be hospitalized or being at a severe risk of infection, or certainly at the risk of death, you want to lessen that. So maybe it's more like, oh, I had a cold, that type of thing. You know, for instance, certain blood cancers that people have. I was talking to the head of the Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Society. That's a blood cancer that their immune system becomes destroyed because of the cancer. They don't respond to the current vaccines that are out there today for COVID-19. And so they're looking for ones that give a longer lasting and broader response to these variants and all. We actually have one that has demonstrated that, and that's why I stay in touch with. But he pointed out to me that most of the people he know, and he suffers from chronic lymphocytic leukemia himself, his blood count, but he said most of the funerals he goes to are people who he's known through, who were patients that had chronic lymphocytic leukemia, so there's blood count. He said they don't die from their cancer. They die from infections because there's not a vaccine that will lessen the impact should they get a particular type of virus such as COVID-19. And so the vaccines, yes, they generally are thought of as preventative because, like with polio, with measles, those types of things. But with other conditions, what they will largely do is hopefully give at least about 12 months of sufficient protective immunity that will minimize, let's put it, or significantly reduce the impact of someone that contracts that virus so that they are not at risk of severe infection, risk of hospitalization, or risk of death. So there is that overlap area, but generally to treat something is a therapy. Like you're treating a cancer, you're treating someone if there's a therapy, and unfortunately, none of the therapies they came out with, these monoclonal antibody therapies that they hoped would be able to treat people with COVID-19, none of them withstood all the evaluation testing.
This is why I wanted to have Mr. Dodd on the show, because I had seen a couple of poll surveys, one that comes to mind by an organization called KFF. When parents were informed about the conflict between the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics, the result was an increased doubt or reluctance about vaccinating their children for COVID and really for pretty much all of the required vaccinations for entering school. And that, I believe, is the mistake of when you believe policy versus science. And what David just explained to you in this segment was indeed the science, which last time I looked at the definition was based on discovery, conclusions through facts. For as a parent, hopefully that is what you'll rely on first and foremost, not someone's wish, whim, or belief unproven. Find out more about what GeoFacts is up to, and you can see and learn more through the media page in particular, get a better understanding of what goes into trials and testing. And there is no rush to market when it comes to vaccines, because that would be idiotic in a variety of ways. The website is geovax.com. He is the CEO of GeoVax. David Don, thank you for the education about the science of vaccines today, and thanks for being here.
Chris, you're welcome, and I wish you and all of your viewers Godspeed and stay safe.